and we're here to discuss Richard Rohr's Living Well, which we introduced last week. We had a look at the basic concepts of the book and the idea of the first half of life and the spiritual transition, if you like, that occurs probably at some point in our lives from one to the other, to this second half, which he tries to define in this book. Amongst the themes I thought we'd talk about this week are, he goes on to talk about rules and the law and the role of rules. And it's interesting that we just began by talking about rules and the people that feel comfortable inside a framework of rules, and those who like to challenge them and think more freely. And so we'll talk a bit about the rules and the role of rules. And then the other theme that follows that in the book is what he calls the role of the tragic, which we'll briefly mention. And then he has this idea of what he calls the stumbling stone, the thing upon which you that you may trip, if you like, on that you may need to trip. And then finally, this idea of what he calls necessary suffering. And what I'll do is I'll just talk about it for a bit with Mark and Kerry, and then we'll open up some of those themes to the rest of you. And we won't spend too long together so that you've got plenty of time. Mark and Kerry, since we've started off talking about rules, I was interested in, he starts in early part on page 28, round there, at least in the version of the book that I've got, talking about some aspects of law and tradition really being necessary in the first half of life. He says on page 28, law and tradition seem to be necessary in any spiritual system, both to reveal and to limit our basic egocentricity, our self-centeredness, if you like, and to make at least some community, family and marriage possible. When you watch 10-year-olds intensely defend the rules of their game, you see what a deep need this is in early life. It structures children's universe and gives them foundational meaning and safety. We cannot flourish early in life inside a totally open field. Children need a good degree of order and so forth.
Yes, I mean, I see that in terms of how before you, the rest of you join, we were talking about the fact that Kerry and Francis and I are all eldest children. When you're bringing up children, you know the importance of giving them a structure and rules by which to live. And those of us who are eldest children, that can sort of live on quite a long way into your adult life. What Kerry was calling before the loyal soldier, which is one of Richard Rohr's terms, the sort of loyal soldier, the sort of autisms which carry on. Sort of sense of duty and all that stuff. But at some point, what the second half of life comes partly through having to sort of leave and discover your own identity and throw off the sort of structures, including religious structures, with which you grew up. Incidentally, I see a sort of second aspect of these rules is institutional church life. In that, as Julia was saying earlier on, people will often start their Christian life in a strict evangelical setting, or maybe a strict Catholic setting. Partly the reason for that is that there you have a sort of strict set of doctrinal statements, including the atonement, which gives you a sort of firm, you know, this is what we all believe. And I think that can be really helpful when we're starting off our journey. But then when we grow up a bit, we want to perhaps throw off some of that and form our own identity. We see that in our own children. And the second thing which may help us to move on is that we actually meet something in our life which our structure simply cannot deal with. And that forces us, in a sense, to fall back, I would say, into the arms of God, beyond the structures. And I think the last thing I would want to say is that those things, which might be some aspect of our upbringing, or there might be a failed marriage, or it might be that our career didn't go as we wanted it to go, or whatever it is, which we might think of as being an awful disaster in our life, and it's painful, but actually, in terms of the second half of life stuff, and Richard, what Richard Rohr says, it actually could be a real means of grace, a real means of by which we grow, we discover who we really are, the true self, which is what Richard Rohr talks a lot about.
Kerry, you mentioned the loyal soldier earlier, and I wonder if you'd like to just say a few words about Richard Rohr's idea of the loyal soldier and what he is, if you like.
Yes, well, it was something that he used to mention quite a bit. I think it relates to the Japanese model, but I can't quite remember. But he mentioned it quite a bit because we can revert to our standardized ought kind of behavior. He likens it to the eldest son in the story of the prodigal son, and the person who did everything right and said, well, why has he done, you know, why is the younger son gone off and been dreadful and come back and welcomed with open arms? So there's a sort of righteous indignation kind of element to us all, especially if you live very much within those boundaries. This is good and this is bad and this is right and that's wrong. And you can see it, we can see it a bit in ourselves, but he does say very much that it's not going to get us to the second half of life. It helps us in the structure, just like Mark's saying, with children, and you were saying with children, and we've got a dog now, but he was a puppy, and it's good when, you know, you have to sort of set boundaries. This is your home, and Richard Rohr mentions his famous dog Venus on the lead and everything. There's a structure to life when you're young. I mean, when we all do anything new, there is a system that we gradually absorb, right? This is what we do, and that forms the culture of something. So as children learning, it isn't all about background, but it's a culture. And that's why people who don't absorb a very strong culture or system, or, you know, are a bit chaotic and quite hard. That's what people often say, you know, we need that structure earlier on, but the structure itself can become limiting when we see, but there's more. How can two things be true at the same time? How can a child die when a God of love wouldn't allow a child to die? Or all the tragedies and all the conflicts and all the paradoxes, two things are true at the same time. So bringing in the sense of paradox, the loyal soldier can sort of get us a bit stuck, I think, is what he would say. And to break through and to rest in the arms of God and know that God has a greater purpose for us can be enabling. And yet we do know, and he does say several times, we need that container, we need that start. I mean, it's like learning anything, isn't it? We need that start and we need the structure. And Julia, you were just saying about that, but if there is more, which I think many of us would believe there is more to life than that, you know, we do this, we go to church, we say our prayers or whatever, if there is more to that, then he has to break through these boundaries.
Yes.
And also, as you were saying later on, that often that hits us when something bad happens and we can't make sense of it.
And these rules are fine up to a point, but I think he also makes the point that the law and tradition can be misused as a, in other words, the rigidity of the framework, or what he calls new tribalism, the idea of sort of adhering too strongly to a particular group's ways of doing things, and like, this is the only way to do things and everybody else is wrong, so we've got to kill them or attack them or what have you, can be very damaging. So the rules can also be can be heavily misused. It's interesting that he talks a bit later about the role of the tragic failure, mistake, and the fact that any life looked at has an element of the tragic in a sense, but that each of these tragedies can move us forward in some way. I know the church has a sort of traditional concept of sin, but interestingly, he says a line which I rather like: Jesus is never upset at sinners, only with people who don't think they are sinners, which I rather liked, really, because Jesus spent a lot of time with sinners and people who had made mistakes and people who had fallen, you know, one way or another. But he didn't seem to condemn them at all. And what he was really, really hacked off with was the people that went round pretending not to be sinners when they actually were, or the people that would deny that they were sinners. And it seems to me that the going wrong is not the problem, really. It's the pretending that one is not weak or the pretending that one is fault free, say, that seemed to upset Jesus.
Yes, I mean, I think the story of the Pharisee and the publican at the steps of the temple is a classic example of that, where it's the publican who says, "Well, I know I've got everything wrong, I don't deserve to be here at all." That's the starting point. It sort of opens us up, the realization that we can't get where we need to get through our own efforts, and it is only by. I mean, that's why I think it's moments of weakness. At the moment, I mean, just to personalize it a bit, I'm about to start a four week course of radiotherapy for prostate cancer. And I've got to go into hospital tomorrow for a minor procedure about that. And as the sort of moment of that gets nearer, you know, you do feel quite weak and vulnerable. Mm. But I know underneath all that, it's okay, because I know it's actually a moment of weakness that you have to sort of leave aside everything, all the structures and all the things by which you live. You just have to sort of fall back into the arms of God. And I know, because I've been there before, that it'll be okay. I'm not saying everything will necessarily turn out okay, who knows? But I know basically all shall be well. You know, that's what she said, Junian of Norwich. Not all will be well, but all shall be well.
Hmm.
And I think that is the underlying truth, which you discover in the course of your own weaknesses and failures and all that stuff which happens in your life.
The final thing I might just bring up before we open it up is, so this point about necessary suffering, because he does suggest that you can't really engineer your own enlightenment, because it could be said, well, okay, we all need to stumble, so let's go looking for something to fall into. And I think he suggests that if you actually attempt to engineer it, to bring it about in order to engineer your enlightenment, it will simply not be successful, because you will engineer it according to your own ego, your own wishes, your own way of wanting to do things. So it will be your own sort of, it will be another form of first half of life control, rather than something that has happened to you that you didn't have any control over whatsoever.
Yeah, he likes to say, I remember on the tapes and afterwards, he sort of bellows out, life is a school and you've got to learn the lessons. And actually, so it isn't looking for something, as you say, for, you know, what banalis thinking, what is this teaching me? But gradually, you know, seeing, like even in the pandemic, seeing the silver linings and the other things, the things we learn this way that we couldn't really learn any other way. I can think of things in my life I've learnt by experience that I couldn't really have learnt in any other way. And trying to also within that, although it's very hard when you're vulnerable, as Mark was saying, to trust that these everlasting arms of God are underneath you and within you. Mark, you and I, Jim Finley, who's on Living School as well, does this thing that God protects us from nothing but supports us in everything. That was, they were the words, aren't they?
And or sustains us.
Sustains us in everything. And that sustaining.
That's a huge thing, huge thing, I think.
Yeah, because people think, how can you believe in a God that does that? But it's the fact that in our normal course of living, things that are outside of our control. And he used to talk about the big five. What we talked about that last time, the sort of life, death, infinity, eternity, love, contemplation, but big five things that just hit us way beyond our logical first half of life.
What was the fifth one you said then?
It was love.
I thought you said constipation, and I can't think you said that.
Contemplation. No, he often says contemplative prayer. And meditation, Mark, can take you to a place that you couldn't get to other than that. And also, I feel that when you're vulnerable, I don't know whether other people feel this, when you're in times of your life when you've been sort of stripped bare of your little anecdotes that you tell yourself or whatever, and you're cut right down to size, you sort of believe more and more in less and less. You know, I just have this underpinning ground of our being, and it can be really desperate, but it can also be quite refining and allow us to you know you can never argue your way with someone who logically, well, my experience and others, I think that you can't logically say I believe in God because of, and actually we forget that most people we deal with, or most people outside the church and maybe our friends, that, you know, don't really have always the sense of imminence and something beyond us. Oh yes, I was going to show something, but to try and describe it, you know, is quite hard. And in the end, you just have to say, well, it underpins my life. It means this to me. Oh, sorry, Francis. If you, maybe I'm wrong to say, but I was just going to show this that I did at the weekend, which is I'm learning about sculpture, and I went on a stone carving day. And what was interesting about that, so that's my, that's the image I find most helpful of me saying, God help, I'm stuck. And God, you know, enwrapping, enfolding me and thinking, I've got you, you know, it's all right. It's that, well, it's more than that. It's the unified sort of circus and of love, wanting and things. But also the lovely image of chipping away. That's what's a bit fascinating about sculpture. You chip away at that bit of you that you don't need anymore, that dross, which is a little bit loyal servant in first half of life. You can unlearn some things, you know, the way the repeated behaviors. And in sculpture, you're like Michelangelo would say, you chip away at this block of stone to find that beauty revealed inside. And anyway, I did it as a meditative exercise. I know that the people around me thought I was completely mad, but it was sort of, you know, trying to get to that inner core of at the end is God, and at the end is this ground of our being holding us in everlasting life, as long as we have ears to hear and eyes to see and are open, being open to something more. So I suppose, sorry, just to bring back to what you were saying, that suffering, you have to be open to the possibility of it teaching us something. And even though at the time it's really hard, no one wants glib answers.
Yeah. I'm going to